Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. One of the most important pieces of real estate in our region is Forest Park. We all know the park, but how much do we know about it? Why and how did regional leaders have the vision to set aside the acreage 140 years ago? And how did it develop into what it is today? The answers to these and other questions are found in a new book called Forest Park. The authors are freelance journalist Holly Shanks and Don Corrigan. He's the editor and co-publisher of the Times newspapers here and professor of journalism at Webster University. Don Corrigan joins me in studio. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, Don.
You just keep writing books.
Well, you know, when you got it in your blood, you can't stop.
Yeah. Well, this is a good one. I think most people in St. Louis and beyond will appreciate it because it's such a wonderful spot, this Forest Park. But, you know, I mentioned in the introduction, Don, that the leaders of 140 or so years ago really had to have some kind of vision to establish this this piece of real estate. Why did they do it?
That's what's really inspiring, because when you look at the politics we're in now and the polarization, you think, how did these people come and pull this together? And, you know, they all found common interests. So, you know, you had the real estate people who wanted a good park where they could build homes. You had the factory owners who thought about the immigrants having some place to do some recreation. Of course, you had the politicians looking for some work jobs that they could give to their constituents. So somehow they managed to come together and really put something great together for St. Louis.
And interesting, it was 1876. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Isn't that the year of the Great Divorce?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, we can overlook that. They did give us a park. So.
But this happened in spite of the fact that there was that sort of thing going on. You know, I think I read in your book that one of the things they were thinking about was ultimately at some point having a World's Fair in the park. Were they thinking that far ahead in 1876?
I think some of them were. And Mayor Francis, who then became governor, that became kind of a pet project for him. I've gone on a few book signings and do some Q&A, and people ask, how did they have the money to do this? The cities decided to come up with $5 million. Congress decided to come up with $5 million. And then they sold these certificates to folks, and that raised another $5 million. Pretty soon they had $15 million, you know?
$15 million in the day was a lot of money.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm not sure where that would get us today.
Not very far.
No.
I suppose not the way, not with our lifestyle.
Yeah.
How about the World's Fair as establishing the park? I mean, was that the thing? Was put the this place is here. It's here to stay, and it's the greatest site ever.
Well, you know, it's funny because when you read about the planners, they always had in mind that we're going to bring this place back to what it was. You know, after we're finished. Well, they just couldn't do that because it had changed the park so much. They buried the De Pere River. They built some buildings that were going to stay. And they realized that they had something good that shouldn't just disappear. So, you know, for example, you take the birdcage that the Smithsonian wanted back, you know, and St. Louis said, no, we like that birdcage. And like 12,000 to 15,000 people were visiting it, you know, every Sunday after the fair. And then we pretty much built a zoo around that birdcage. That was the genesis of the zoo.
And when did they actually do the zoo? When did that happen?
Well, you know, you have to look at various pieces of it. But I think the zoo came around 19... the Zoological Association, which is kind of, there's an interesting picture of that group in the book. And they got together afterwards, and they said, we need to put this zoo together. And that was the beginning. And 1916 is when they established it. And one of the things these guys said, these directors of the Zoo Association, was we want this to be free. Mm-hmm. A lot of us came from Europe, and the zoos were reserved for royalty and the rich and the elite. We're going to find a way to make this free. It's been free ever since. I just came back from a vacation in Naples. I went to the Naples Zoo. She says, you're from St. Louis. I have to apologize. Mm-hmm. We charge. And you get that all over the country because we're known as the zoo that has is so accessible for the people.
You know, I lived in Baltimore for a period of time, and they have a park there called Druid Hill Park, set up very much as Forest Park is, not nearly as spectacular. It also includes a zoo. My question is this something that other cities were doing at about this time, establishing these big parks?
No, and I don't think you can find a park in the country that has a zoo, an art museum, a history museum, a muni. And a lot of those things really originated from ideas that were left from the World's Fair. So, there are a lot of first-class institutions in all those cultural areas across the country. But what's great about our city is you can go to Forest Park and you can get a taste of all of it.
How difficult was it to establish these institutions in the park? Did that require a lot of working around red tape and that sort of thing?
I think the World's Fair sort of paved the way for that, mm-hmm. because they had a lot of those different palaces of education, palace of the arts, palaces of metals and mining. So it's not like there wasn't precedent before mm-hmm. to put those in the park. So, and then you also had these different associations, and they had some of these institutions in sort of embryonic form in the city or other places. Mm-hmm. But they got together after the fair and they said, you know, we really belong in that park. We really need to continue what happened with this fair.
Who was in charge of it at the time? In other words, if the History Museum wanted to establish a site there, where would they go to get the ball rolling on this?
Well, you had some city leaders that were very amenable to these ideas. And it's always been, you know, part of the city of St. Louis. So basically going to officials.
Just like they would have to do today, I suppose. It was pretty much the same
right.
kind of thing.
Right.
You know, one thing we didn't mention about this era at the turn of the century was something else was going on in 1904. It's called the Olympics. Big deal, a big deal to have the Olympics. I think this Olympics, too, is the first one in which they awarded medals. I may be wrong on that, but it was a historic event.
Yeah.
Big deal. How important was that?
Now we have a big deal in Los Angeles coming up. I guess you saw that they're 2024, 100th anniversary.
Well, it's going to be a big deal. Mm-hmm. But we had nothing in place for now. It is a big deal to have, you know, various arenas and venues for the events. Nothing like that in Forest Park in 1904.
Mm-hmm.
What did they have that would make it attractive to the Olympic sports?
I would guess that if you look at how much sports are played in the park and what they had, especially back in that era, it should have been an idea that set off a light bulb for them. I would imagine there was a certain amount of exhaustion after doing the World's Fair. And frankly, I'm glad that it went the way it did, because that's what really created what we have today, with the cultural institutions. And so I don't necessarily regret that they didn't go that route.
What do you mean? What route are you talking about?
Go the route of trying to then attract the Olympics.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, it was certainly a big deal. Who was using the park in that day? You said early on that they wanted a place for the immigrant population, and I guess the less affluent, if I may put it that way, population, to have a place to recreate. Were they the ones who were using it?
No, I think at the beginning of the park and even before, you know, officially was dedicated in 1876, it was part of a place for the elites. It was a place for horse riding and horse carriages and that sort of thing. But it evolved. And once it became dedicated, again, you had various constituencies that wanted to have sports in the park. I find it interesting in doing research that a lot of the factory owners were saying things like, we want immigrants to have a place to recreate, but we also want them to learn teamwork mm-hmm. because that's vital to us. And so they actually intervened and created these spaces for what you would say are the lower classes. It was an elitist thing when it started.
Well, there is still a debate, as you well know, with regard to facilities there. There are people who say there should be a basketball court in Forest Park.
Yeah, and I'm certainly not against that, but we do have to be a little concerned about it being loved too much. When you think of that, there's like 13 to 14 million people using the park every year. That's one of the concerns. I think there's so much there already. And you know what it's like as a St. Louisan to go there on some Saturdays and Sundays. It's a traffic jam. But it's a good traffic jam once you find your spot.
It could be. You know, looking at the neighborhood surrounding the park, to the north, obviously, Lindell Boulevard and those magnificent houses along, you know, from Skinker to Kings Highway in particular, were they there first or did the park attract them?
The park attracted them, and that was part of the motivation of the real estate interests who got behind having the park, is that we want a location where we can build these kinds of residences. Mm. Of course, on the other side of the park, you had Dogtown, and that's a whole another story.
Well, it is another story, one that is often told, but no one's quite sure about the story as to how and why it was named Dogtown. But it may have come from the World's Fair.
Yeah.
Do you think you could tell the story as you understand it?
You know, I was just reading about this yesterday because I was at a restaurant in Dogtown. But they mentioned the story that everybody knows that, you know, one of the things that they brought in for the World's Fair were international visitors. And they said that there were certain tribes from, you know, the southeast of the world who loved dog. And all of a sudden, dogs started disappearing from Dogtown. I'll let some other investigative reporters sleuth that to find out how much accuracy there was to that. But it's a story that's been around for a long time.
It's been around for a long time. And again, I'm sure I saw this in your book, that in fact that one of the things that visitors to the fair came to watch were Philippine exhibitors, if you will, actually eating dog on site.
Yeah, political correctness did not really seeped into our culture at that point. There were a lot of things in the fair that we would probably look askance at today. But when you look at all those palaces, it was really in some ways a technological utopia because it predicted so many of the things we were going to eventually have. And I just find it amazing that they had this huge tower, the DeForest Tower, that was cranking out Morse code, and the newspapers were looking at it and saying, hey, this is something that we should look into. They're really ahead of their time.
And electricity, electric lights in particular, big deal at the fair.
Yeah. Of course, then getting onto the culinary aspect, then you start talking about how many people were introduced for the first time to the hot dog and the hamburger and iced tea. I get a kick out of the iced tea thing because when I was a graduate student, I went to London. This was some years ago. But I ordered iced tea, and the whole place looked at each other, and they laughed. He wants ice in his tea. And I said, well, I'm from St. Louis. We invented iced tea.
Well, there are a couple of those stories are in doubt, too. I know that the hot dog, hamburger, ice cream cone, people are saying, maybe not. Maybe that happened someplace else.
Yeah. I've seen some historical accounts that say that, yes, those things were started at the World's Fair. And then you see maybe the ones that are a little more modest, and they say people were introduced to those things for the first time.
That's the way to get around it. We're talking with Don Corrigan. He's the author, co-author, I should say, of Forest Park. His co-author is Holly Shanks, not with us today, unfortunately, but Don is. And we're talking about the park. And if you'd like to talk with us, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. Or if you'd prefer to send us a tweet, do so at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Don Corrigan, co-author of the book Forest Park. We couldn't talk very much about the park without talking about the Muni. And one of the photos that caught my eye, Don, in your book was that of a very young Cary Grant, known then as Archie Leach, who apparently spent one summer here performing in the Muni. But really caught my attention was there was no cleft in his chin. It's like maybe he acquired that somehow later.
I know the Munis, just going through the archives and seeing all the famous actors and actresses, you know, whether it's Bob Hope or Yul Brynner, Richard Harris, Debbie Reynolds, Red Skelton, Ethel Merman, Phyllis Diller and John Travolta in more recent times. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in doing the research, the thing that really caught me was actress Mary Ricks, who came up with the famous quote that the Muni on a warm summer night with a full moon, the orchestra playing, and a tenor voice singing is the closest to heaven as many of us will ever get.
Uh-huh.
I think that's a lovely quote. Although I have to say that I went on the hottest day of the year to see the unsinkable Molly Brown. My daughter was in from Denver, and she lives about three blocks from Molly Brown's old house. And I said, "You got to go." So, you know, and it was a roaster, but we still enjoyed it. It's such a wonderful place to, and you know, I remember as a kid. How often did you go there? How many performances have you been to over the years?
I mean, are you asking
me? Yeah,
many, but I was never there as a kid because I came here a little bit later in life.
Yeah, yeah.
But oh yeah, many.
Yeah.
Who was it? Was it Yogi Berra or Whitey Herzog who talked about Busch Stadium and says it sure does hold the heat well? Same can be said at times for the Muni.
Well, they do have some new fans, but yeah. You know, they've always had those fans, and they've always taken off the edge a little bit.
Sure.
But my parents dragged me to see Camelot and Brigadoon and all the classics, and it cracked me up because right after that, my mother had to buy the soundtracks to those, and we listened to them nonstop for 6 months.
Yeah.
And
it's a great institution,
yeah.
And it offers the opportunity for so many young people to become acquainted with these classic shows that have been around for a long time and will endure for a long time more.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you think about the park, and one of the you talked about young people and the opportunities they're getting, every one of those institutions is so active in bringing young people in. You know, it's a place to get civilized.
Mm-hmm.
Forest Park is a place to get civilized. We need a little bit of that right now.
You're right. You know, and talking about holding the heat, I do know that I guess during the Depression years in particular, a lot of people from around St. Louis would go to the park and sleep at night so they could be a little cooler than they could be in their homes, often tenement buildings.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Some people were asking me when it was 108, what did people do before air conditioning? And I said they slept in the park. And I
exactly.
said, no, they didn't. And I said, oh, yeah, they did. I said, the photos are in the archives, the Post and elsewhere. And it actually might have been kind of a fun evening.
It might have been, yeah, a social event. We'll talk more about those archives in a moment. But Liz has a question, and she's called in. So let's bring her into the conversation. Liz, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Don. How are you?
Great. How are you?
Good. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I wanted to find out if the writer had any information in his book about Steinberg Skating Rink and if there was any plans to bring the roller skating back, because I grew up roller skating in Forest Park, and that is something that myself and some of my generation of people from maybe the late 60s to the early 80s until we went off to college, skated there, and wanted to find out if there's any history in your book about the roller skating rink.
Thanks for the call.
I don't have history about the roller skating rink in the book. I do have the history of the Steinberg family and how Mrs. Steinberg mm-hmm. wanted to endow an ice rink because she was so impressed by what she saw with in New York with Rockefeller Center and Central Park. Boy, but, you know, that's a memory. This is kind of a memory book in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And it's a book that people can get nostalgic about. I remember as a grade school kid, one of my friends taking me to Steinberg and just, you know, skating on there was an experience because you looked up and there were these things that looked like skyscrapers mm-hmm. along King's Highway.
Yeah.
Just a great experience for everybody. That's one of the things I really look forward to with doing book signings. We've done a few already. But you know this yourself from doing books. That's half the fun of doing books is listening to everybody share their stories.
I don't remember any roller skating in the park.
I don't.
There's inline skating now, obviously, on the bike paths, but nothing like Liz was talking about.
Sure.
Tell me about acquiring these photos. I should point out that the text is somewhat limited in the book. You've got a lot of photos in here. How did you acquire these?
And that's typical of an Arcadia book because mm-hmm. all of their series is images of America. In fact, we had to sort of talk them into getting as much copy as in the book
really?
Because they tend to be more photographic. Holly would be in the best position, Holly Shanks, who co-authored it with me, mm-hmm. because she really did the legwork and went from institution to institution. Forest Park Forever approached me to write this book after they got some inquiries from Arcadia. And I said, I don't have the time to do all that archive work, but Holly, who's a student of mine who now does social media for my newspaper group, mm-hmm. She went to all those places. I was hoping that Forest Park Forever would have one sort of vast archive for all these things. It was a lot more work because each institution is, you know, sort of covetous of what they have.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned Forest Park Forever because that organization really turned the park around. I can remember before they got going, the park was someplace that people were a little bit leery of.
Well, we owe them so much. I mean, the city and them partnered and they raised, you know, over $100 million in a 10-year period to revive so much of the park. And that's one of the, you know, we talk about the battles now in the country mm-hmm. to replace our infrastructure and repair our infrastructure. That's another success story. That's one of the things I like about this book is it's a success story. People can get things done when they put their mind to it.
You know, I walk in the park a lot. And after an event, even after the VP Fair, Fair of St. Louis, whatever it's been called these days, where a lot of people are in there and they're discarding a lot of paper and debris and what have you, the next morning it's clean as a whistle. I mean, you can't give them enough credit for what they do in that park.
Yeah. Well, you know my mm-hmm. environmental bent.
Right, exactly.
And I do spend some time talking about happenings in the book, including Earth Day, which I think mm-hmm. is marvelous and a marvelous location. But Forest Park Forever also has all these different programs they have to introduce people. So they have a program for the wild and getting people into the wild to see all the fish and birds and reptiles and mammals in the park. You know, you just don't think mm-hmm. of that as a place where Audubon Society members are going to go with their binoculars, but they do. And then they have the Voyage of Learning Academy for teachers. And that's a great program because the teachers then go back to the classroom and bring the kids into the park. And then they have the NatureWorks program. So from an environmental standpoint, and I do spend the last chapter of the book showing pictures of these kids discovering nature. It's just, you know, heartstrings kinds of photos.
I get it. We've had Mark Lenshaw on the program a couple of times. I don't know if you know him. He's the owl guy. He takes people at nighttime tours to observe the great horned owls. And it's always a very popular segment. And there they are. I mean, they're critters that most people don't think exist in the park.
Now, here's a project that my wife is lobbying me to do, and that is the Thursday night boat picnics. From the boathouse. Are you aware of those?
No.
They're supposed to be just a phenomenal experience, and you get to see the park in a way that you never would.
You know, this is really an interesting part of the whole conversation, is that, as I said in the beginning, everybody knows Forest Park but doesn't know about Forest Park. And I'm learning stuff here today, and I've lived next to it for almost 10 years, and I'm learning things about it during our conversation and certainly through your book. What did you learn in researching the book? Was there something that jumped out to you that said, I didn't realize that?
I'll tell you one thing that it did is it made me a regular visitor to the park.
Yeah.
So just 2 weeks ago when my daughter was in, you know, we went to the Muni. We went to the History Museum. We went to she wanted to see the Raining Men exhibit mm-hmm. at the, you know, the Art Museum. And they're all great experiences that you'll remember. It's not something that it's like a movie and 3 weeks later you can't even remember what the plot was. You know, you go to these kinds, whether it's Route 66 at the History Museum or or one of the art shows, they stay with you. You talk about them for a long time.
There is literally something in the park for everyone. I mean, you'll find something in there that will be of interest to you, no matter who you are or where you've come from.
Yeah, we could go on for hours. I mean, we could talk about Jim the elephant and Phil the gorilla.
Oh, sure.
And now Callie the polar bear.
Right, and we could talk about Marlon Perkins, and we could talk about Gene
sure.
Kelly, and we could talk about any number of things. But folks can get their fill of that, or at least a taste of it, in the book, Forest Park, co-authored by Don Corrigan, our guest, and by Holly Shanks. It's a great, fun book. Don, congratulations to you once again on yet another book, and thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's a lot of fun.
Don Corrigan, journalist and co-author with Holly Shanks of the book Forest Park. This is St. Louis on the Air, St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.